So it's a pleasure to be speaking at Perimeter. Hopefully at some point in the not too distant future, be there in person as well. And of course, it's always a pleasure to talk about the black hole information paradox in recent years, because as this title suggests, we're in an age of developments and exciting progress, the age of what I've been calling holographic entanglement entropy, age of holographic entanglement entropy, which has really resulted in a paradigm shift in the way that those of us who work on holography have viewed the black hole information problem. So while I gather that you are all by now experts on the black hole information paradox, since you've seen multiple talks not so long ago, I will nevertheless still spend some time introducing the black hole information paradox from the perspective that is most conducive to understanding these recent developments. And I'll begin with sort of a 60,000 foot view, specializing to a 30,000 foot view, and we'll get to the 10,000 foot view, and then maybe kind of hover there rather than going sort of kersplat on the ground. So the 60,000 foot view is really just a series of questions. Of course, at this most basic level, what is the black hole information paradox? And at the 60,000 foot view, you can think of it as a conflict between two very well-tested, empirically tested theories, which is to say classical gravity, general relativity, and quantum field theory. And of course, GR is extremely well-tested in the regime of large massive objects, stars, galaxies, clusters, and so on. And quantum field theory is very well tested at the smallest scales. Now, you might, of course, say justifiably so that, well, okay, we all know that general relativity and quantum field theory don't play well together. So why don't we just say that the black hole information paradox is just the need for a quantum theory of gravity, which we all know we need. I mean, you hear all over. General relativity can't be quantized in any way that we can make sense of non-perturbatively. So why is this black hole information paradox any different from just the quest for quantum theory of gravity? And the answer is that general relativity, what we call semi-classical gravity, is a really good effective field theory. And what we mean by that is that the weak interaction between general relativity and quantum field theory describes large portions of the universe extremely well. In particular, we expect that this limit describes the universe well. This nearly decoupled limit of these two theories is a very good description of the universe whenever space-time curvatures are very small on large scales. And the information paradox is a contradiction between these two theories, between the predictions of quantum mechanics and general relativity, in a regime where we expect effective field theory to be valid. In other words, in a regime where these two theories should not be contradicting. Like the room around you, well, there's gravity and there's quantum field theory, but they're not in interaction with one another in strong interaction. And so the black hole information paradox is a problem because it's a conflict between two theories in a regime where they should not be conflicting. So that's the very, very broad perspective. Now, why do we study the black hole information paradox? Well, of course, it's a paradox. So nature just does what it does. And a paradox is evidence that we're not describing nature correctly. And so this is sort of telling us where to zero in on getting a better understanding of quantum gravity. Now, in particular, since we now know that black holes exist, we have good evidence that black holes exist thanks to LIGO and the Event Horizon Telescope, that means that we would like to have a good understanding of what lies inside black holes, of a quantum theory of gravity more generally, since there are phenomena in the universe that will require the deep interior of a black hole, will require a quantum theory of gravity. So the black hole information paradox stands to teach us a lot about quantum gravity, which is one reason to study. And I'll talk a little bit more about other reasons to study the black hole information problem. Now, how do we make progress on it? That's really the content of the rest of this talk. So that question will hopefully be at least somewhat addressed by the end of this. So let me zoom in from the 60,000 foot view to the 30,000 foot view. What is the black hole information paradox? So this phrase that I've been using, semi-classical gravity, this is the weakly coupled limit of quantum gravity. So limit where quantum fields are very weakly interacting with their gravitational field. And it's, of course, it's valid in regimes where space-time curvatures don't register very much on quantum scales. So for example, near the event horizons of very large black holes, sufficiently large black holes, space-time curvatures are low, and we expect that semi-classical gravity, effective field theory, is a good description of the physics. Now, the information paradox is a prediction of semi-classical gravity that contradicts quantum mechanics. And in particular, the reason it's a paradox is because in order to fix it, you require large modifications to semi-classical gravity at the event horizon of a black hole, where semi-classical gravity should not require large modifications, in a regime where semi-classical gravity is expected to be valid. So this is the essence of the paradox. We have a contradiction. We have semi-classical gravity not being valid, giving us predictions that don't make sense from the perspective of quantum mechanics in a regime where semi-classical gravity should be an excellent description of the physics. Now, what is this prediction that gives us this problem? Well, semi-classical gravity predicts that black holes can evaporate. And I'll discuss a lot what that means and why we expect that shortly. But the basic prediction is that black holes can evaporate and that the process of black hole evaporation, according to semi-classical gravity, violates unitary evolution of closed quantum systems. So in quantum mechanics, closed systems always evolve unitarily. And semi-classical gravity predicts that black hole evaporation violates unitarity of closed quantum systems. So there's direct violation of unitarity of quantum mechanics, which tells us that either quantum mechanics is wrong or semi-classical gravity is wrong in a regime where there should not be a problem with either. Now, I already mentioned one reason why we might care about the information paradox, but there is another one. There is at least one more, which is that if we have a loss of unitarity, we call that information loss for reasons that will become evident shortly. Now, what does that mean? Information loss or loss of unitarity in evolution of semi-classical gravity, evolution of the universe, is a loss of determinism. In particular, it means that if we have two different stars that both collapse into black holes, and those two black holes evaporate, and we look at the universe after the two black holes have evaporated, it is impossible for us, in principle, to evolve this system backwards in time using the equations of motion and tell that this universe had two different stars in it. In particular, what that means is that when the black hole evaporates and radiates, it is impossible to distinguish the radiation of one black hole from the other. It's impossible for us to tell that the universe initially had these two different stars. And that's a catastrophic loss of determinism, because it means that given initial data today, it's impossible for us to post-dict the past, which of course, predictions and post-dictions are the bread and butter, the purpose of what we do here in physics. That we're given some initial data and we can evolve it forwards or evolve it backwards in time and prescribe what happens, the dynamics of the system. Now, another reason that I mentioned earlier is that black holes exist. Nature has a definitive answer on what happens at the black hole event horizons. And of course, without an answer to this question of what happens at the event horizon of an evaporating black hole, our description of physical phenomena in the universe is going to be incomplete. Now, it's not that we've observed an evaporating black hole so much as that we need to understand this because we need to understand quantum gravity, which we expect describes the interior of black holes, which we expect to exist in our universe. So all in all, the black hole information paradox certainly has a lot to teach us about quantum gravity, provided, of course, that we can actually learn about the black hole information paradox without knowing everything there is to know about quantum gravity. Now, I mentioned earlier that there was a big paradigm shift in 2019 in terms of our understanding of the black hole information paradox. So what happened? What was pre-2019 and post-2019? What was the big change? Before 2019, the perspective was that if you wanted to see that information is conserved, that the universe evolves unitarily, you actually needed quantum theory of gravity, a full, non-perturbative, direct quantum theory of gravity. And the basic idea, the basic conventional wisdom, was that semi-classical gravity is simply inconsistent with unitary evolution. there is no analysis that you can do that uses the tools of semi-classical gravity. Quantum fields on a curved space-time, for example, areas of surfaces, things you can compute just from quantum field theory on a curved space-time. But this is just always going to be inconsistent with unitary evaporation. Of course, this is not a resolution. We don't know why quantum gravity becomes necessary on scales that it shouldn't make a big difference on, but this was the conventional wisdom. Pre-2019. Now, what happened in 2019 that changed things? What happened was a purely semi-classical analysis using, again, quantum fields on a curved space-time, areas of surfaces, et cetera, that was consistent with unitary evaporation of black holes, with information conservation, which most of us thought was impossible. So I think it's safe to say most of us thought that black hole, that having this purely semi-classical analysis that showed unitarity, that was consistent with unitarity, was impossible. So here, yeah, so most of us thought it was impossible, right? So this is the basic idea. What was then, what happened in 2019. So now I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about the black hole information paradox more at the 10,000 foot view and explaining my perspective of, perspective that is helpful for understanding these recent developments. Then I'll introduce the tools that were necessary for the 2019 developments. I'm going to call the age of holographic entanglement entropy and the idea behind the calculations. And I'll talk about the calculation, the 2019 calculation in some detail. And also I'll speculate a little bit on where we're going and talk a bit about what happened since 2019. Okay, so our story really begins, as most good stories in physics do, with thermodynamics. So there is a very famous statement in general relativity, so the so-called no-hair theorem, which is that black holes in classical gravity have no microstates. So they're completely described by their so-called asymptotic charges, basically global properties like the mass of the black hole, how fast the black hole is spinning, whether it's charged. And so John Wheeler came up with this Gedanken experiment that is very puzzling. You take a black hole and you throw a hot teacup into it. Now, black holes having no microstates means that they have no entropy. So hot teacup, on the other hand, well, it's got temperature and it's certainly got entropy, got a lot of microstates. Now, if you take your hot teacup and you throw it into the black hole, then you can decrease the entropy of the universe, because once you've thrown it into the black hole, well, now it's part of the black hole and black holes don't have entropy because they don't have microstates. And you can actually arbitrarily decrease the entropy of the universe just by throwing stuff into black holes. Now, this sounds pretty bad when you consider the following quote, which is one of my favorite quotes in physics, by Sir Arthur Eddington. If your theory is found to be against the second law of thermodynamics, I can give you no hope. There is nothing for it but to collapse in deepest humiliation. Now, Wheeler preferred general relativity to not collapse in deepest humiliation. So he gave a project, it's a little premature, he gave a project to his student, Jacob Bekenstein. Solve this. And Jacob Bekenstein remarkably rose up to the challenge. So Bekenstein said, actually, black holes do have microstates. They are thermal, they have a temperature, they have an entropy, and this is all due to microstates that are not coming from classical gravity, but from quantum gravity. That black holes have quantum gravity microstates, and the entropy of a black hole, which counts in microstates, is given by the area of the black hole's event horizon over 4 in Planck units. This is known as the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, which is very nice because you can either think of it as black hole or Bekenstein-Hawking. Now, what is Hawking doing here? Hawking actually computed the temperature of a black hole. So Bekenstein proposed that the temperature by analogy is going to be inversely proportional to the mass, and Hawking actually computed this proportionality constant. Okay, so one thing that I want to emphasize here is that this is critically dependent on having quantum effects. So it is absolutely crucial for this entire story to be consistent that we consider quantum corrections and not just black holes in classical gravity. Black holes in classical gravity have no microstates, they have no entropy. They're also perfect absorbers, which means that they can't have a temperature or they would be radiating. Okay, so we keep in mind that the quantum corrections are very important for this entire story to hold. Now, okay, if a black hole has temperature, since black holes are thermal objects, Bekenstein and Hawking telling us their thermal temperature means that the black holes can radiate. And if the black hole temperature is larger than the temperature of its surroundings, the black hole is hotter, then as it radiates, it shrinks, its mass decreases. But recall, the temperature of a black hole is inversely proportional to its mass, which means that it just gets hotter and it evaporates more and it gets hotter until eventually it explodes altogether. And actually Hawking's original paper on this was called Black Hole Explosions. So some numbers to ground us. The Hawking temperature of Sagittarius A star, the black hole at the center of our own galaxy, is 10 to the minus 14 Kelvin, really cold. Now, as we get smaller, they're going to get hotter. So this a solar mass black hole would have a temperature of approximately 10 to the minus 8 Kelvin. A lunar mass black hole would be approximately at equilibrium with the cosmic microwave background. And a coronavirus-sized black hole would be very comfortable at room temperature. So you have to get really small for temperatures to be appreciable, for Hawking temperatures of black holes to be appreciable. Okay, so now, let me go back one slide. So in order to talk about evaporating black holes, it pays to first discuss briefly collapsing black holes. So here we are imagining that this is a star. It's not a very exciting star, it's just a sphere. And time here is going to run upwards. So here we have this ball, a sphere that I'm suppressing one of the dimensions. And as time evolves forward, this sphere is going to be shrinking under the force of its own gravitational field. Eventually, it enters its own Schwarzschild radius and then event horizon forms. And the black hole continues, the star continues to shrink. Eventually we get a singularity. So here we have the event horizon. So this is roughly the picture that I'm going to be to have in mind here of a collapsing black hole. Now, what about black hole evaporation? Well, here we have a caricature of pairs of particles that are entangled floating around in space-time. And it is just popping in and out of existence around the vacuum. So they can come up here, 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 or they can also straddle the event horizon. This is a property of the vacuum. We can always have these coming out in and out. Now, this particle here that's outside of the event horizon can go off to infinity. This particle is, of course, doomed to stay inside the black hole forever. And so these particles that move out are carrying away energy and cause it. This is what we call the black hole radiation. And again, as the black hole radiates, it shrinks until eventually it explodes altogether. It gets hotter and hotter. So here we have the picture of the pair of particles. And again, time is running upwards here. The event horizon, you can see, is shrinking as we fall forwards until eventually we have an explosion. Now, in this language, the paradox is that semi-classical gravity, effective field theory, you know, gravity weakly coupled to quantum fields, predicts that during this process, we lose information. That this process at some point becomes inconsistent with unitary evolution. Now, how do we diagnose this non-unitarity, violations of unitarity? There are many different ways to do this, but one particularly convenient quantity to use is the von Neumann entropy, which is defined for a density matrix as minus trace of rho log rho. Now, why is this valuable for us? Well, it has many properties, but three of them are particularly useful. One, it's invariant under unitary evolution. So obviously, if we're testing unitarity, then it's good to have a quantity that is invariant under unitary evolution. It vanishes for a pure state and only for a pure state. So if our density matrix can be represented as a vector in the Hilbert space, then this is going to vanish altogether. And finally, it's bounded from above by the thermal entropy, which is just log of the dimension of the Hilbert space, also called the coarse-grained entropy. So these three quantities are going to be very useful for us in diagnosing unitarity and non-unitarity of black hole evaporation. Now, why do we call the absence, the loss of unitarity, information loss? That's called the information paradox. The rough intuition here is that the information in a state rho can sort of roughly be quantified in terms of the difference between the thermal entropy and the von Neumann entropy. So the idea here is that essentially the thermal state has essentially no information content. And so if a system evolves to progressively larger von Neumann entropy, then the Vonnegut entropy gets progressively closer to the thermal value. It's bounded from above by the thermal value. And information is lost since it's getting to the sense in which it's getting progressively closer to the thermal state. Now, this actually happens all the time in open systems. So open systems will routinely see quote unquote information loss. Now, of course, it's not a problem because quantum mechanics only requires unitarity of closed quantum systems. Now, the entire universe is not an open system, we don't expect. So we do not expect that the Vonnegut entropy of the entire universe should be increasing. Now, let's take a look at a toy model here to try to understand why is it that semi-classical gravity predicts this, this loss of information. So let's take an entangled pair of particles, a Bell pair. So we have Alice who ends up inside the black hole, and we've got Bob who ends up outside of the black hole. And psi here is the pure state of the two of them together. So here's a pure state. Now, if we only want to describe Bob, then we have to trace out over Alice's degrees of freedom. And that can only be represented as a density matrix, which is in this case, just a maximally mixed density matrix, 1/2 times the identity. And again, this is obtained by tracing out the degrees of freedom associated to Alice's system. Now in this toy model of the EPR pair, initially the state of the pair is pure. S initial equals zero, since the Vonnegut entropy of a pure state is zero. After the black hole has finished evaporating, Alice is gone from the system. She went into the black hole and now the black hole has disappeared altogether. So of the pair, if we look at the state of the pair, it's just the state of Bob, since Alice doesn't exist anymore anywhere in the universe, not even inside the black hole, because the black hole is gone. And so the final Vonnegut entropy after the black hole has finished evaporating is just the Vonnegut entropy of Bob. And the Vonnegut entropy of Bob is log 2. It's not zero. And so we see that the Vonnegut entropy of the pair went from zero to log 2. And so the system was not evolving unitarily. And of course, this is a toy model for what happens, but it gets the general idea across. Let's talk a little bit more accurately here. Let's suppose that our universe starts out in some pure quantum state. Purity of the quantum state is not critical here, but it makes it pedagogically easier to understand what happens. So we have some universe, it starts out in some pure quantum state psi. We're going to form a black hole in this universe. Maybe it's got some stars, it's got some matter, the black holes can form. Now we want to compute the Vonnegut entropy of the black hole exterior. Okay, we can do that. So we start out, you say, okay, well, before the black hole is formed, certainly the black hole exterior is just the entire universe, which is in a pure quantum state. So the Vonnegut entropy starts out as zero. Now it's going to be increasing once we look at just the outside of the black hole. That's a subset of the system. That's okay. It's okay for the Vonnegut entropy to increase. It's an open system. The subset, the outside of the black hole exterior is an open system since it interacts with the black hole interior. So the entropy increases. This is a calculation, very beautiful calculation that was done by Hawking. And Hawking's calculation shows that once the black hole finishes evaporating, the entropy plateaus at the thermal value. Okay, so sorry, this skipped a bit of this. So one second. Oh, there we go. Okay, so this is the picture here. So before the black hole started evaporating, we just have some star. We're looking at the state of the universe. There's some star over here. This is a pure state. During the process, we're only looking at what's going on outside of the black hole. We're computing the entropy of the radiation. So this is a single moment in time, each one of these. This one here is the full time evolution. So we look at some time over here, looking at the entropy outside. This is this. And then afterwards, we look at the entropy and we find that it is the entropy of the maximally mixed state. The Vonnegut entropy, we find this is the maximally mixed state once the black hole has finished evaporating. Okay, so what does semi-classical gravity tell us? Well, semi-classical gravity says that the post-evaporation state is mixed. So if you compute the Vonnegut entropy of the black hole exterior, it's mixed. Now the black hole exterior is just the entire universe now, keep that in mind. Standard quantum mechanics tells you the evolution of the entire universe, assuming it's a closed quantum system, is unitary. That means that the state of the entire universe at one time is related by a unitary to the state of the universe initially. In particular, this is a unitary, and so the Venneman entropy of the entire universe, the Venneman entropy of psi of t, is going to be equal to the Venneman entropy of psi, since these are related by a unitary, and the Venneman entropy is invariant under unitaries. And so this, of course, is zero, since the Venneman entropy of a pure state is also zero. So standard quantum mechanics says whenever you're computing the entropy of the entire universe, it's always zero. Semiclassical gravity says that the Venneman entropy after the black hole has finished evaporating is greater than zero. So the conflict is that, again, quantum mechanics says that the Venneman entropy of the universe should always vanish, but the Venneman entropy of the exterior here is equal after evaporation to the Venneman entropy of the entire universe. This should vanish. This does not vanish. So here's the contradiction. Now, here is the Hawking curve that computes the Venneman entropy of the black hole exterior, which again, here is just the entire universe, plateaus at the thermal value. Now, what would we get if the evolution were unitary? Well, we would say, okay, it starts out at zero, the Venneman entropy. And then we're just looking at a subset of the system. It's an open system, the black hole exterior. So the entropy is allowed to increase for a while. But eventually the black hole finishes evaporating. Another black hole exterior is the entire universe, which should have zero entropy. So at some point, this curve has to go back down to zero, which means that we are looking for a non-monotonic curve that first increases and then at some point starts to decrease. Now this curve here is named after Don Page for first proposing it and also computing when the turnover takes place, which is roughly after more than half the black hole has evaporated. Now, which of these is the correct curve for quantum gravity? And how do we compute it? So that leads me to the age of holographic entanglement entropy, which brought us the tools that we need to compute a unitary curve for the entropy, the Page curve, using semiclassical gravity. So a bit of a preview before I get into the technical analysis. It's really hard to see where Hawking's calculation goes wrong. It's a very robust calculation. It's hard to see where he could go wrong in a way that would actually fix the problem. Maybe we need input from quantum gravity to figure this out. We don't want too much input from quantum gravity because that would violate the validity of semiclassical gravity at the event horizon. So somehow we would like quantum gravity to have input here so that we can see unitarity, but at the same time, without making too much of a contribution so that we can still say that semiclassical gravity is valid where we expect it to be valid. Now these new developments basically gave us exactly that. So they're a completely semiclassical calculation of the Page curve, the curve that goes up and comes back down with indirect input from quantum gravity, which allowed us to still work within semiclassical gravity and not violate the validity of having actual space-time and perturbative interaction between gravity and quantum field theory. Now, what is this indirect input from quantum gravity? The indirect input comes from the holographic principle. So what is the holographic principle? It's the statement that certain models of certain types of quantum gravity in a box, so with basically in anti-de Sitter, so with boundary conditions at infinity that are reflecting boundary conditions of a box, is dual to a lower dimensional non-gravitational quantum field theory, frequently a conformal field theory. So here I've drawn a caricature. We have some anti-de Sitter space in d plus one dimensions and conformal field theory in one lower dimension. Now, why is this useful? Well, it's very useful because we understand quantum field theory a whole lot better than we understand quantum gravity. And so if we understand the dictionary that is this duality, the ADS-CFT correspondence, if we can understand the relation between the two, then we're well placed to get a better understanding of quantum gravity. Now we sort of have affectionate terms for the two objects here. The ADS quantum gravity we'll call the bulk, and the quantum field theory we will call the boundary. even though it doesn't actually live on the asymptotic boundary, but we'll call it the boundary nevertheless. Okay, so what is the very powerful statement that comes from holography that helps us with the information paradox? Well, an immediate implication is that a black hole in anti-de Sitter space is just an ordinary non-gravitational quantum system. It's just a state of this lower dimensional non-gravitational quantum field theory. That's all that a black hole in anti-de Sitter space is. So here we have some object in the bulk and its hologram on the boundary. It's just an ordinary non-gravitational state. Well, okay, if a black hole is an ordinary non-gravitational closed quantum system, and we know that non-gravitational closed isolated quantum systems evolved unitarily, then clearly ADS black holes must also evolve unitarily. This is simply from the ADS CFT correspondence. So does that mean we're done? We've solved the problem, black holes evolve unitarily, congratulations, we're finished? Not really. We would like to understand better how quantum gravity manages to preserve unitarity. What actually happens at the event horizon? Does semiclassical gravity actually break down? How can we possibly reconcile that with the fact that curvatures at the event horizon can be approximately the same order of magnitude as curvatures near the sun? Maybe one order of magnitude stronger. How do we reconcile the two? Well, let's think about it in the following way. So let's approach it in the following way. We know that the usual formula in the bulk, if we just do Hawking's calculation in the bulk, we're going to get the Hawking curve. So this is just the same Hawking's calculation, just adapted to anti-de Sitter space. That's going to be information loss. So nothing really changes. And there's a little bit of technical difficulty, but essentially the basic story doesn't change. If you're working in anti-de Sitter space, we're still going to go from a pure state to the maximally mixed state when we do Hawking's calculation in anti-de Sitter space. Now, on the back of the soup can, meaning in the dual low dimensional non-gravitational quantum field theory, we just have a unitarily evolving system where the von Neumann entropy is not changing. It's just, or the full system. So the von Neumann entropy is evolving unitarily. Information is conserved. Okay. So we have two calculations here. We have a non-gravitational calculation of a unitary entropy. That's the lower dimensional non-gravitational quantum field theory. We have a gravitational calculation of a non-unitary entropy. That's Hawking's original calculation. So we want to try to bridge the two. What if, instead of using this gravitational calculation of a non-unitary entropy, instead of using minus trace rho bulk log rho bulk, we use the holographic prescription for computing minus trace rho boundary log rho boundary? In other words, we know this object evolves unitarily. Why don't we figure out how to compute this object in the bulk using the ADS CFT correspondence? The correspondence duality means that there exists some gravitational quantity that corresponds to this quantity here. How do we do it? This, if we can do it, then that would give us a gravitational calculation of a unitary entropy. So that would allow us to bridge this non-gravitational calculation of what we want of unitarity and the gravitational calculation, I guess, of what we don't want, non-unitary answer. If we can figure out how to calculate this unitarily evolving quantity in gravitational language using the ADS-CFT correspondence, then you can have a gravitational calculation of a unitary entropy. And it's kind of remarkable, it actually does. So let's see how this works. So let me illustrate the two options here. We have a geometric non-unitary calculation we can do, that's Hawking's calculation. That computes the von Neumann entropy of quantum fields in the bulk here. We have a non-geometric calculation, that's just a calculation we do in the boundary theory, that's unitary. It's a mystery, you know, how this corresponds to gravity, but it gives us a unitary answer. Now, what we want is sort of an option three. We want to use the holographic dictionary to compute this using the language of that. So, as I just said, compute this using this language. How do we do that? To do that, we need to know how to compute the von Neumann entropy of the boundary state in the language of the bulk, the language of quantum gravity. Fortunately, we have that. This is the holographic entanglement entropy prescription, which catalyzed the age of holographic entanglement entropy, as I referred to in the beginning. So what is the formula? The formula tells us that the Vonnegut entropy of this state on the boundary, rho boundary, can be computed in the bulk theory by the following formula. The area of a surface that I'll explain what it is in a moment, the area of a surface chi over 4 in Planck units, plus the Vonnegut entropy of quantum fields outside of the surface. So this here is a moment in time. This is our surface chi. Then we're computing the area of this over 4 in Planck units plus the Vonnegut entropy of these quantum of the state of the quantum fields outside of it. This quantity here is it was actually defined a long time ago for arbitrary surface by Jacob Bekenstein. It's called the generalized entropy. Now, how do we pick out this surface chi? The surface chi is what we call quantum extremal. What does that mean? It means that if you take the surface and you slightly wiggle its location, then the generalized entropy doesn't change to leading order in this perturbation. So in other words, these are stationary points of this functional. So again, you slightly perturb the surface, it's not going to change. The generalized entropy of the surface will not change to leading order in the perturbation. Now, it may turn out that you have multiple such quantum extremal surfaces. In that case, we use the one that has the smallest value of the generalized entropy. If you're thinking right now of a saddle point approximation, where you might use the one with something with the smallest action, you are thinking correctly. That is the general logic behind this. So this is the dictionary entry that relates for us boundary entropies, entropies of a unitarily evolving quantum field theory, to quantities in semi-classical gravity. And that leads me to what happened in 2019. So here we have ourselves an evaporating black hole. Technically, it's difficult to make an ADS black hole evaporate, but that's you can solve that technicality. So I'm not going to spend time on it, but of course, please do feel free to ask during the Q&A if you're curious. So here we have a black hole in anti-de Sitter space, and it is evaporating. So let's take a look at what happens here. Well, where is the quantum extremal surface? Right? We're looking to compute the Vonnegut entropy of rho boundary, which we know evolves unitarily. So to do that, we need to use the quantum extremal surface prescription, which is telling us to find the minimal generalized entropy quantum extremal surface. So initially, here, before the black hole is formed, we can ask, where is the quantum extremal surface? And as it turns out, there's only one quantum extremal surface here, and it is the empty set, the trivial quantum extremal surface, which tells us that the Vonnegut entropy here at these early stages is just going to be, we're just computing the Vonnegut entropy of all of the quantum fields in a complete time slice of the universe. Okay, fine. We keep on doing this. This is when we have the black hole forming, entropy begins to increase. And then about halfway through the evaporation process, a quantum extremal surface appears, a non-trivial new quantum extremal surface appears. It appears just behind the event horizon here. So this here is a moment of time. This is this moment of time here. This quantum extremal surface lives just behind the event horizon of the black hole. And it appears shortly before the turnover in the page curve, but until we actually get to the turnover, its generalized entropy is actually larger than that of the empty set. So we keep on using the empty set. But once we reach the page time, the time at which the curve starts to turn over, this quantum extremal surface actually begins to have smaller S gen than the empty set. And so this one becomes the dominant contribution to the Vonnegut entropy. This one is how we compute the boundary Vonnegut entropy. And miraculously, or I guess not so miraculously if you believe the ADS-CFT correspondence, the generalized entropy of this surface, unlike the generalized entropy of the empty set, actually begins to decrease. And we do in fact recover the unitary page curve from quantum extremal surfaces. And I want to emphasize here that this does not require us to use any kind of non-perturbative quantum gravity techniques. We used areas of surfaces and Vonnegut entropy of quantum fields propagating on our curved space-time. We did not need to include brains or strings or anything non-perturbative in quantum gravity, non-perturbative quantum effects. The only place where quantum gravity came in is in telling us that we can compute the entropy using quantum extremal surfaces. So let's take a step back here. What happened here? We have this formula. The von Neumann entropy is the generalized entropy of quantum extremal surface. Now, the fact that we have this new quantum extremal surface is really what saves the day. It allows us to have this turnover instead of just an increase in the von Neumann entropy. Now, the only place where quantum gravity appears here is not in the computation of the area term, it's not in finding the surface, it's not in computing the von Neumann entropy of quantum fields outside the surface, it's in this equality, in telling us that in the ADS-CFT correspondence itself, telling us that the von Neumann entropy of this gravitational system can equally well be computed by this boundary theory and by this quantum extremal surface formula. Now, why does this work? Why does quantum gravity repackage entropy in terms of quantum extremal surfaces? What microscopic Planckian physics is responsible for the success of this quantum extremal surface prescription, which may a priori seem like a bit of a black box? Well, there has been some progress on this front following the 2019 papers. So let's ask, how might we generally compute an entropy? Well, we don't have to invoke gravity for this. We can just ask, let's compute entropy in some non-gravitational quantum field theory, quantum mechanics. Well, for this, we can use the so-called replica trick. The replica trick involves introducing n independent copies, so-called replicas, of the system. So here we have n copies of the system, and essentially uses this relation between trace rho log rho and this formula here. You compute trace rho to the n, where rho here is the density matrix on these n independent copies of the system. And we take the derivative respect to n, eventually we take the limit as n goes to 1. So this is just the replica trick for computing the von Neumann entropy. This is a very tried and true and old trick in general, not necessarily in gravity. Now, we actually do understand the replica trick in holography. We know how to relate trace rho to the n of the dual quantum field theory to the so-called gravitational path integral. Now, what is the gravitational path integral? This is it's basically what it sounds like. So this is a path integral where you set the boundary conditions of your space-time and you integrate over all metrics that can fill in those boundary conditions. Now, of course, integrating over all metrics means literally you integrate over everything, not just the metrics that are on shell. But we often are able to work in a saddle point approximation when we work with, and look at, in particular, at metrics that solve the equations of motion that will dominate the gravitational path integral. Now, you can actually justify the new quantum extremal surface, the one that leads to unitarity, using the gravitational path integral. So even if you are skeptical about ADS-CFT, and maybe you're not sure how much you really buy the duality, you can also derive this just by working with the gravitational path integral. You can say, well, I think that the path integral certainly computes some kind of a quantum gravity partition function. And that's already enough to allow you, assuming you're okay with a saddle point approximation, to justify the quantum extremal surface formula for the von Neumann entropy. Now there's a cost here. Of course, there's no such thing as a free lunch, which is that these n independent copies of the system appear to be inheriting some kind of non-trivial correlations. And this is a little bit unusual and surprising and unexpected given that these are n independent copies of a single quantum theory. So why, how can they be correlated? And there's been a lot of work on this front with suggestions that there is some kind of ensemble averaging happening. Maybe you're averaging over some parameters in the problem. There's been suggestions that you're averaging over states, some kind of a coarse graining that is involved in obtaining the semiclassical limit that is the reason that you're seeing apparent correlations between independent copies of a single quantum theory. Now, this more or less brings us to present day. And let me say just a little bit about some very recent developments, which I guess I wouldn't say they're taking place tomorrow. They've taken place very recently, but I hope that they will continue to evolve in the coming days, weeks, months, and years. So let's think about what we've got here. We have two different calculations that use the tools of semiclassical gravity. We have Hawking's calculation, which is not consistent with a pure eventual out state. And we have the quantum extremal surface calculation, which is consistent with a pure out state. Okay. How do we bridge the gap between these two? How do we, in some sense, tell what was missing from Hawking's calculation? Now, one perspective on how to bridge the gap between these two calculations, both of which take place with the tools of semiclassical gravity, is that in the language of quantum extremal surfaces, Hawking's calculation corresponds to using the wrong quantum extremal surface, the one that's not dominant, the one that's not minimal, the empty set. That is Hawking's calculation in the language of quantum extremal surfaces. Here's another perspective. So we say, okay, you know, the unitary calculation is correct. ADS-CFT tells us black holes evolve unitarily. That means that the radiation of a black hole eventually purifies itself. Its Von-Neumann entropy begins to decrease halfway through the evaporation process. Even so, it actually turns out that it takes an exponentially powerful quantum computer to detect that the radiation purifies itself. In other words, if you throw a diary into the black hole, and the information in the diary eventually gets radiated out as a black hole evaporates, you would need an extremely powerful quantum computer, exponentially one of a G Newton, to read the diary contents from the radiation. So that seems hard. So here's a hypothesis on how we can bridge the gap between Hawking's calculation and the quantum extremal surface calculation. If you were an observer who were computationally restricted to sub-exponentially hard tasks, in other words, you did not have access to such a powerful quantum computer that you could execute tasks that were exponentially complicated in one of a G, then you'd never know that the radiation purifies itself because it takes exponentially powerful quantum computer to actually tell. So here's a hypothesis. Hawking's calculation coarse grains over exponential complexity. All right, that's a hypothesis. How does this mesh with the idea that Hawking's calculation actually is just using the wrong quantum extremal surface? Right, those two, we want a consistent explanation of what the difference is between quantum extremal surface calculation, which is unitary, and Hawking's calculation, which is non-unitary. Then, we'd like to understand how does this hypothesis, which seems reasonable, is consistent with the previous expectation that Hawking is just using the wrong quantum extremal surface. Well, as it turns out, the holographic avatar, the holographic entry dictionary entry, of exponential complexity is actually a non-minimal quantum extremal surface. If you have a non-minimal quantum extremal surface in your system, then something in your system is going to be exponentially hard to decode. And so in particular, using the wrong quantum extremal surface is equivalent in every way to coarse graining over exponential complexity. And so there is a unified story, at least from the perspective of holography, of what is different between Hawking's calculation and the quantum extremal surface calculation, which is simultaneously using the wrong quantum extremal surface and coarse graining over complexity. So let me wrap up with the current status. So if I had to summarize the black hole information paradox in one sentence, I'd say we haven't solved it yet. But that's not entirely fair. We're getting closer. A few questions that are interesting and under current investigation. What entropy is the quantum extremal surface or gravitational path integral calculating in quantum gravity? Can we compute it directly from the formula minus trace rho quantum gravity log rho quantum gravity? What does an observer outside of the black hole actually measure? If you were floating around with a bunch of beam splitters and mirrors and collected all the radiation, you had an arbitrarily powerful quantum computer. Could you feed it to that quantum computer and actually read the contents of your diary? Is the path integral, the gravitational path integral, doing an averaging of some sort? Is semiclassical gravity emergent from an averaging over some parameters, over couplings, over some kind of an ensemble? What are the internal dynamics of an evaporating black hole? Another question that we need to address. And finally, if the bridge between the unitary quantum extremal surface calculation and Hawking's calculation is indeed computational complexity, or equivalently, non-minimal quantum extremal surfaces. How do we understand it in the language of Hawking's original calculation, which didn't say anything about computational complexity and did not use quantum extremal surfaces? In my opinion, that is the crux of understanding the resolution to the information paradox. So with that, I will thank you for your attention.
Okay, feel free to unmute or clap as you wish to thank Netta for that wonderful talk. Could I start by asking if there are any questions from students? Questions from students? If not, Namrata, Namrata, yes, go for it.
Yes. Hi, this was a absolutely wonderful talk. Thank you so much. Yeah. So the question I had was why did you put the quantum extremal surface, like, you know, halfway when you had that diagram and then you showed us like halfway through the black hole evaporation? Does it matter where it is, or it only matters that there is another one, which is, you know, which like basically makes the curve like go downwards?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Let me go to that slide. Almost there. There we go. Good. So the quantum extremal surface appears, it nucleates about halfway through the evaporation process. So it does appear before it actually begins to be significant. In the quantum extremal surface prescription, the only surface that matters, the only quantum extremal surface that matters, if you have more than one, is the one where the generalized entropy is smaller. So the one that minimizes the generalized entropy. So here, for example, at this moment in time, we have two competing quantum extremal surfaces, the empty set and the surface chi. And after we reach the place where we want the curve to turn over, once we reach that place, then this surface begins to have generalized entropy that is smaller than that of the empty set. It does exist for some time before that place, and there its generalized entropy is actually larger than that of the empty set. So we don't bother with the surface because it's not the correct one. It becomes the correct one at a certain time. And in particular, there's a moment in time where the two have identical values of the entropy. And then eventually, then after that, this one, and this is just a single moment in time, the surface sort of evolves with time. This is the one that begins to dominate after that. And when I say dominate, I mean have a smaller value of the generalized entropy. Now, that said, it doesn't exist for all time. It appears sometime after the black hole has been evaporating for a bit, but before it's evaporated half.
Okay, so it seems like there is some kind of significance of why it happens at whatever time it actually happens. Do we know its correlation to, like, how do I say this? Do we know why it happens the way it does, or that's one of the unanswered questions? Because we get it, like, doing a calculation, it happens. But why? Like, let's say if you're looking at a black hole, or like you're looking at a system with a black hole, then why would it form there, and why that point? Like, why that point in time?
Yeah, no, that's an excellent question. So on a mechanical level, we sort of understand it, you know, all of these gradients come here, and these, you know, this the derivative of the area looks like this, the gradients and the entropies look like that, and we sort of match it all up and it works out beautifully. On a level of what mechanism in quantum gravity is responsible for sort of cherry picking this that it just works? Sort of not really. I mean, we understand we have the gravitational path integral. We can see this becomes a dominating saddle, but again, it's a sort of a more mechanical understanding of it. So it's understanding the mechanism in full quantum gravity that makes this work is in some sense almost tantamount to understanding what is exactly the process by which the information actually gets out. And we have not understood that yet.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you so much. Oh.
Manu, go for it.
Yes, thank you for the wonderful talk. And so my question is, I'm just trying to relate all the talks about the information paradox that we've had in the past. And so I would like to ask that what are the extra elements, means what is the setting in which the calculation is done? In the sense that the last time when we heard about this, the comments were when comparing the two approaches, which was maybe not going to that approach now, but was that there is some thermal bath that you couple your black hole to or your ADS to, and then there are some which causes some the gravity to become massive or something like that, which maybe I don't understand it completely, but what are the extra elements and how physically viable are they?
Yeah, so I think you're asking about the way in which we force ADS black holes to evaporate.
Yeah.
So the way we force ADS black holes to evaporate for everyone else in the audience is ADS black holes, why don't they evaporate? So what happens is you have an ADS black hole, suppose it tries to evaporate. Radiation comes out. As it turns out, the radiation can actually reach the boundary, which is infinitely far away in finite time. It's a strange feature of ADS. And so the radiation reaches the boundary in finite time and bounces off of the boundary. It comes back in, back into the black hole, and the black hole grows again. And so eventually the black hole just reaches equilibrium with its radiation and it doesn't evaporate altogether. Now, of course, you could just circumvent this by having a very small black hole that evaporates so fast that the radiation doesn't quite manage to make it back in time. Unfortunately, the holographic understanding of such tiny black holes is we don't understand them very well holographically yet. So it seems like a bit of a catch-22. So what we do to force a large ADS black hole to evaporate is we say, okay, forget those reflecting boundary conditions at infinity. Those are clearly the problem here. Let's instead put transparent boundary conditions at infinity and put in a cold bath at infinity. And that means that the radiation will go out and it'll go into the cold bath and it'll stay there. It's not going to come back in because we have transparent boundary conditions. And so that's great. That allows us to evaporate the ADS black holes. Now, of course, you could come up with some concerns. You could say, well, maybe the details of the way that you remove the coupling, the way that you remove the reflecting boundary conditions, the details of how you couple this cold bath to the black hole, maybe that is responsible for the way you are for these quantum extremal surfaces or the details of the dynamics of the system. It turns out that the system, the evolution of the system and the quantum extremal surface are actually independent of the coupling of the details. So there was a very nice paper. So this was something that we argued for in a not particularly rigorous way in our paper in 2019, but much more recently, there was a paper by Rafael Busso and Arvind Shabazi-Mogadam, where they actually argued fairly convincingly, I would say, that this is a broad and general feature of evaporating black holes that is independent of the way you choose to couple them, also somewhat independent of the asymptotics, with some asterisk about the sitter, where even in asymptotically flat space, we expect the same kind of universal behavior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just, maybe one comment towards the last sentence was, I think, is what I feel the problem is the final resolution would lie of the information paradox, where you said that if you could somehow do a Hawking-like calculation and figure out, I mean, in this, because I think this whole direction relies heavily on the ADS-CFT correspondence, which, like many people believe, is ADS is not our universe. And therefore, if a Hawking-like calculation, if we could somehow get hints from here and do a Hawking-like calculation that reproduces the thing, that would solve that counter when people say that it's not our universe, ADS is not our universe. So, Miss, I think it's at least that counter I feel is can if that last sentence that you wrote on the slide, last sentence of the talk, if that works out, I think, yeah, that would be solving the information paradox at the core, because Hawking's calculation didn't assume any ADS or any, means that would, that could be done for a generalized Schwarzschild black hole.
So I guess I have a couple of comments on that. So let me just go to that last sentence. So I would say, so when I say Hawking's original calculation here, I don't mean literally the words that he wrote in the paper. Mm-hmm. I mean the language of Bogoliubov transformations and quantum fields propagating on a curved spacetime, and essentially just the way you can, and you can do this in ADS, right?
Yeah, you can
do this type of calculation, and you can get the exact kind of violation of unitarity in ADS that you can in asymptotically flat space. So I would say that the asymptotics, I don't expect, are particularly important here. Mm-hmm. Now, you could say, okay, maybe they are, maybe they're not. I would say, since we have an information paradox in anti-de Sitter space, then if we can resolve it in ADS and understand how quantum gravity resolves the problem in ADS, I would say we're miles closer to resolving mm-hmm. it in any other set of asymptotics.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, Timothy, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for the very nice talk. I just wanted to ask a clarifying question about just the boundary side. So you have this plot of entropy of rho boundary going up and down.
I was wondering if someone would catch on to that. Yeah, I think I know what you're going to ask.
So my question is just like, should the x-axis really be of time, or should it be like a subsystem size?
Right? Yeah. Yes. So this is what happens when people are paying close attention. Let me go there. Sorry, this is going to take a moment. Almost there. Okay, great. Good. So you'll notice here that I cleverly put S, but did not say S of what. So yes, the idea here is that this we're looking at the subsystem that corresponds to the radiation in the bulk. So if there's a black hole in the bulk that's evaporating, we are interested in computing the von Neumann entropy of that of the radiation, which corresponds to just some subsystem of the dual theory. Now, in the setup of a small black hole that's some subsystem that we don't really understand, in the setup of the large black hole where we add in this cold bath at infinity, that corresponds to computing the entropy of that bath, because all the radiation ends up in there. So again, we can think of that as a coupling between two quantum field theories. So again, it's two quantum field theories, non-gravitational and unitary. But you're absolutely right that this S here is computing a subsystem of this quantum field theory, not of this dual quantum field theory, not the von Neumann entropy of the full system. If it were, it would just be absolutely just flat.
Okay, but what if I didn't want to think about or couple in this extra bath? Like, mm-hmm. because it seems like the information paradox could be, you know, well posed just for a single closed system with, you know, pure state boundary evolving in time.
It absolutely is.
Right.
So you have two ways to think about this. So you can think about the bath as just an extra system that you're adding in, and it's basically reflects the same thing. Now you can say, I don't want that bath. Mm-hmm. Well, if you don't want the bath, then the problem becomes that your black hole, large black holes don't evaporate in ADS. So without the bath, you just don't have an okay, there is a sense in which you can get an information paradox, but it's not this information paradox. It's sort of a different one, which is involves growth, the fall off of correlators at late times. But other than that, which you can also pose and talk about. But if you wanted to talk about the ADS CFT correspondence, and you wanted to talk about black hole evaporation, and you were really attached to the idea of having reflecting boundary conditions, then you'd have to talk about small ADS black holes. And unfortunately, it's well posed, and we expect that they evaporate unitarily, we don't have a good understanding of the duality that relates observables and subsystems of small black hole spacetimes to boundary quantities. So that's the problem.
Right. So you're saying you would need like a detailed mapping between the radiation in the bulk and a particular subsystem on the boundary. And that's
right. We have that in the case of the bath. And in the case of a non-evaporating black hole, but we don't have it in the case of a small evaporating black hole.
I see.
For a large evaporating black hole with a bath, or a non-evaporating black hole, but not for, yeah.
Okay.
Can I ask a question about relating? We had, as I mentioned, one of the earlier colloquia on this topic was by Suvrat Raju, and he was arguing that, I guess he and collaborators have been arguing that sort of Hawking's mistake was more about the assumption that the total Hilbert space can be written as the tensor product of the interior Hilbert space of the black hole and the exterior Hilbert space, and that actually when you take the basically the Hamiltonian and momentum constraints of GR into account, that the interior and exterior, basically the Poisson equation, links the interior Hilbert space to the exterior Hilbert space, and that so that basically the exterior entropy never grows like it's like in the initial phase, yeah. Like you draw in the initial phase of the page curve. What is your perspective on that argument?
I don't agree with that. Because you can get an information paradox when you just have a two-dimensional gravity, there's no gravitons, or three-dimensional gravity with no gravitons, and a scalar field which factorizes. So with Hilbert space factorizes. So if you don't have gravitons and you don't have some kind of a gauge field that's going to give you factorization problems, then any argument that relies on factorization issues is not going to apply, and yet we still get an information paradox in that case. So I don't agree that this is a critical aspect of the black hole information problem, and I don't agree that the page curve is not as flat.
Okay, thanks. So you say it's even though there's still an analog of the Poisson equation in 2+1, for example, there's mm-hmm. since there's no gravitons, there's no
right. There's no gravitons, so you don't run into yeah.
Hmm. Okay, well, I'll have to think about that. Are there any other questions? If not, then let's thank Netta one more time for a wonderful talk.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.